CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure Season 4 in American Tragedy. I am your host, your friend, your ear lover, and literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black. You could probably hear just through these first few words, I'm suffering mightily. Oh man, I'm recording this on the day of the eclipse, and somehow that eclipse brought with it just horrible hay fever. Been sneezing all day. I know I started last episode by complaining about my allergies, but then we were on that cruise for a week, and out there in international waters, wasn't a problem. Come back here to this damn city filled with trees and pollen and Spanish moss, spores everywhere, clogging up my nasal passages and making me sneeze and my eyes water and a sniffle, and I probably sound horrendous. And what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Not much, other than take allergy pills, which is what I've been doing. They don't seem to be helping very much. So I told you last time I was going on this cruise, and we did. It was a poker cruise, I think I mentioned. And the idea of a poker cruise is you get on the boat and you play poker all day. You look out the porthole windows at the sea going by, and you're betting and making money hand over fist out there on the boat. Although, of course, that's not what happened with me. The problem, well, first of all, the cruise was great. I mean, I just had a great time. There were two main drawbacks with the cruise. The first was the comedy shows, of which I was a part, were just terrible from start to finish. I'm not saying the comedians were bad, but it was just a terrible environment for comedy. Poker players from all over the world assembling on a boat with no interest in or really understanding of comedy. The shows were poorly attended, and the response to all of us was, at best, mediocre. We did have a couple good shows. Now, I performed, like, I feel like eight times on this goddamn boat. Of those, I would say two, maybe three, were not horrendous. So that was one bad thing. The other bad thing, oddly enough, was the poker. The poker was just terribly organized. The cruise was put on by a company called the World Poker Tour. And you've probably seen them on TV. They host poker tournaments all over the globe, hence the name World Poker Tour. So this was the first time they'd taken over an entire ship. And they didn't have enough dealers. They didn't have enough tables. It was difficult to get chips and deal with the money situation. And then at the last night, when I wanted to be playing poker, instead I had to stand on a line for 2 hours just to settle up my bill. And it was just a real pain in the neck. However, I'm just going to go back. I'm going to say the overall experience, fantastic. Had a great time, met some fine folks, hung out with Martha, got a little sunburn on my left foot during our day in Bimini, had some decent food, got plenty of sleep, was up late, you know, but would sleep till 11. I mean, it was just fabulous. I loved it. I love being on cruises. I'll tell you one guy who did not want to return to land, this guy. But here I am, back in Savannah, hardly able to breathe. and with hundreds and hundreds of pages of An American Tragedy all arrayed before me. Now, I will say this, because last time we were talking about the different social strata there in Lycurgus, and it did occur to me, as I was complaining to my friend, fellow comedian Jade Catapretta, who was on board with me, and we were complaining about our lives, as we were both enjoying an all-expenses-paid cruise, basically to nowhere, but up and down the Caribbean, we understood the absurdity of us complaining as we were enjoying this all-expenses-paid cruise. But it's a little bit like we're in Clyde's situation. Like, you know, there's kind of no lower position on a ship, I think, than being the comedian on a cruise ship. My God, is there anything more depressing than that title? But that's the title we had. So in a sense, we were in our own shit pit, just as Clyde is starting out his career in a shit pit. The difference is that I'm not starting my career. I should be out of the shit pits. But, you know, for a poker cruise, I'll go back in. And Clyde, having left the shit pits on his first day of work, is walking around Lycurgus and seeing the different ways that people live from the bottom to the top. He saw the shanty town out there, and he saw his uncle's grand manse. And that's kind of where we left it. Clyde taking a sort of sociological survey of Lycurgus and determining that his immediate place in that, the sociology of Lycurgus, is somewhere towards the bottom, but with the possibility of rising by trading on the name Griffiths. So, why don't we pick it up there? Book 2, Chapter 25, An American Tragedy. That's me trying to get oxygen into my lungs. And Clyde, walking to and fro from 8 until 10, when as though by prearrangement the crowd in the more congested streets seemed suddenly to fade away, leaving them quite vacant. And throughout this time, contrasting it all with Chicago and Kansas City. What would Ratterer think if he could see him now, his uncle's great house and factory? And because of its smallness, liking it, the Lycurgus Hotel, neat and bright, and with a brisk local life seeming to center about it, and the post office, and a handsomely spired church, together with an old and interesting graveyard, cheek by jowl with an automobile sales room, and a new moving picture theater just around the corner in a side street, and various boys and girls, men and women, walking here and there, some of them flirting, as Clyde could see, and with a suggestion somehow hovering over it all of hope and zest and youth. The hope and zest and youth that is at the bottom of all the constructive energy of the world everywhere. And finally, returning to his room in Thorpe Street with the conclusion that he did like the place and would like to stay here, that beautiful Waikiki Avenue, his uncle's great factory, the many pretty and eager girls he had seen hurrying to and fro. So that's not the end of the chapter, but there's a little like space there, you know? Sometimes they do a little chapter break within the chapter, kind of set a new scene. So that's what's going on there. But yeah, I mean, you know, like Kurt just sounds great. We're pre-depression, right? We're pre-globalization. There's lots of manufacturing and industry popping up all over the country and on the East Coast. Times are booming. People want stuff, you know? They got a little money in their pocket after the conclusion of the First World War. They want to put difficult times behind them. It's the Roaring Twenties, by God. People are celebrating. Flappers are flapping. Dandies are gallivanting around with floozies on their arms. You know, it's a good time to be alive. Good time to be young and zestful and hopeful and energetic. In the meantime, insofar as Gilbert Griffiths was concerned, and in the absence of his father, who was in New York at the time, a fact which Clyde did not know, and of which Gilbert did not trouble to inform him, he had conveyed to his mother and sister that he had met Clyde, and if he were not the dullest, certainly he was not the most interesting person in the world either. Encountering Myra, as he first entered at 5:30, the same day that Clyde had appeared. He troubled to observe, "Well, that Chicago cousin of ours blew in today." "Yes," commented Myra, "what's he like?" The fact that her father had described Clyde as gentlemanly and intelligent had interested her. Although knowing Lycurgus and the nature of the mill life here and its opportunities for those who worked in factories, such as her father owned, she had wondered why Clyde had bothered to come. "Well, because, I will answer this, Clyde is poor and is hoping to work his way up." "Well, I can't see that he's so much," replied Gilbert. "He's fairly intelligent, not bad-looking, but he admits that he's never had any business training of any kind. He's like all those young fellows who work for hotels. He thinks clothes are the whole thing, I guess. He had on a light brown suit and a brown tie and hat to match and brown shoes. His tie was too bright, and he had on one of those bright pink striped shirts like they used to wear 3 or 4 years ago. Besides, his clothes aren't cut right. I didn't want to say anything because he's just come on, and we don't know whether he'll hold out or not. But if he does, and he's going to pose around as a relative of ours, he'd better tone down, or I'd advise the governor to have a few words with him. I guess the governor is Papa. Outside of that, I guess he'll do well enough in one of the departments after a while as foreman or something. He might even be made into a salesman later on, I suppose. But what he sees in all that to make it worthwhile to come here is more than I can guess. As a matter of fact, I don't think the governor made it clear to him just how few the chances are here for anyone who isn't really a wizard or something. Well, maybe Clyde's a wizard. You ever think about that, Gilbert? Takes a wizard to come up from where Clyde has already come up. He had nothing. He was out there begging on the streets of Kansas City, and now he finds himself within a hair's breadth of this great mansion in Lycurgus. His shirt may be too pink and his tie too bright, and his style may be 3 or 4 years out of fashion, but that Clyde's a quick kid. He'll pick up soon enough the mode of style and manner of the finer Lycurgus families. You can bet your bottom dollar on that. He stood with his back to the large open fireplace. Oh, well, you know what Mother was saying the other day about his father. She thinks Daddy feels that he's never had a chance in some way. He'll probably do something for him, whether he wants to keep him in the mill or not. She told me that she thought that Dad felt that his father hadn't been treated just right by their father. Myra paused, and Gilbert, who had had this same hint from his mother before now, chose to ignore the implication of it. "Oh, well, it's not my funeral," he went on. "If the governor wants to keep him on here, whether he's fitted for anything special or not, that's his lookout. Only he's the one that's always talking about efficiency in every department and cutting and keeping out dead timber." Meeting his mother and Bella later, he volunteered the same news and much the same ideas. Mrs. Griffiths sighed. For after all, in a place like Lycurgus, and established as they were, anyone related to them and having their name ought to be the most circumspect and have careful manners and taste and judgment. It was not wise for her husband to bring on anyone who was not all of that and more. On the other hand, Bella was by no means satisfied with the accuracy of her brother's picture of Clyde. She did not know Clyde, but she did know Gilbert, and as she knew, he could decide very swiftly that this or that person was lacking in almost every way when, as a matter of fact, they might not be at all, as she saw it. "Oh, well," she finally observed, after hearing Gilbert comment on more of Clyde's peculiarities at dinner, "if Daddy wants him, I presume he'll keep him or do something with him eventually." At which Gilbert winced internally, for this was a direct slap at his assumed authority in the mill under his father, which authority he was eager to make more and more effective in every direction, as his younger sister well knew. Well, here we are, in the midst of a sibling spat, and we are perhaps seeing glimpses into a sibling rivalry. There you've got Maya and Bella, both capable young women, but neither of whom is being groomed for any sort of position at the factory because, after all, they are but mere females. And Gilbert, his feathers all ruffled at the sight of Clyde in his brown suit and hat and his pink shirt, thinking to himself, why, this hayseed falling in to town from the hinterlands, what good is he to anybody? Nothing. He's no good. He's nobody. Piece of shit came in on the wagon train from Chicago. I've got friends like that who are very quick to judge when they meet somebody. And I have been known to do that myself. And I'm trying to break myself of the habit, you know, trying to break myself of thinking that every bubba that walks down the street here in Savannah is in fact a bubba. You got to break yourself of these habits, judging people too quickly and too harshly. Most of the time, we're just speaking to our own insecurities when we note somebody is lacking in some respect or another. I would suspect most of the time, the real person you're pointing your finger at there is yourself, son, yourself. We call that projection, don't we? Well, I'm nothing but a country psychiatrist, but I know projection when I see it. And that's what that is. Projection. Projection. Oh, God. I don't know if the allergy medicine is making me loopy or what, but I gotta take a break. Back in a minute, here on Obscure.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Back in Obscure, contemplating taking a stronger pill, a kind of Benadryl-adjacent pill that I know what the effects will be. It will probably stop the sneezing, but it will also dry me up to the point where it's going to be hard for me to sleep. And that's, I got to weigh the pros and cons with this, you know. Anyway, back to the book. Gilbert Griffiths, none too impressed with his young cousin Clyde, and to be fair, young cousin Clyde, not too impressed with Gilbert. It is possible, perhaps even likely, that they see in each other, they see themselves. And what do we like least when we see it in other people? That which reminds us of ourselves. So there's some tension there. Okay, so Gilbert had just said it's not his funeral. The dead timber, you know, they're talking about, why are you bringing on Clyde if he's just dead timber? And Bella's basically saying, well, you know, it's daddy's call, not yours, idiot. Daddy's in New York, so you don't get to say shit. In the meantime, on the following morning, Clyde, returning to the mill, found that the name, or appearance, or both, perhaps, his resemblance to Mr. Gilbert Griffiths, was of some peculiar advantage to him, which he could not quite sufficiently estimate at present. For on reaching number one entrance, the doorman on guard there looked as though startled. "Oh, you're Mr. Clyde Griffiths," he queried. "You're going to work under Mr. Kammerer. Yes, I know. Well, that man there will have your key." And he pointed to a stodgy, stuffy old man, whom later Clyde came to know as Old Jeff. Old Jeff the time clock guard, who, at a stand farther along this same hall, furnished and reclaimed all keys between 7:30 and 7:40. When Clyde approached him and said, "My name's Clyde Griffiths, and I'm to work downstairs with Mr. Kammerer," he too started, and then said, "Sure, that's right, yes, sir. Here you are, Mr. Griffiths. Mr. Kammerer spoke to me about you yesterday. Number 71 is to be yours. I'm giving you Mr. Devaney's old key." When Clyde had gone down the stairs into the shrinking department, he turned to the doorman, who had drawn near, and exclaimed, "Don't beat it all how much that fellow looks like Mr. Gilbert Griffiths. Why, he's almost his spitting image. What is he, do you suppose, a brother or a cousin or what?" "Don't ask me," replied the doorman. "I never saw him before. but he's certainly related to the family, all right. When I seen him first, I thought it was Mr. Gilbert. I was just about to tip my hat to him when I saw it wasn't. And in the shrinking room when he entered, as on the day before, he found Kemmerer as respectful and evasive as ever. For, like Wiggum before him, Kemmerer had not as yet been able to decide what Clyde's true position with this company was likely to be. For as Wiggum had informed Kemmerer the day before, Mr. Gilbert had said no least thing which tended to make Mr. Wiggum believe that things were to be made especially easy for him, nor yet hard either. On the contrary, Mr. Gilbert had said he's to be treated like all the other employees as to time and work, no different. Yet in introducing Clyde, he had said, "This is my cousin, and he's going to try to learn this business," which would indicate that as time went on, Clyde was to be transferred from department to department until he had surveyed the entire manufacturing end of the business. Well, exactly, that's what I would think, too. Here's a young Griffiths come calling in his fine brown suit, albeit 4 or 5 years out of fashion. And if I know anything about the Griffiths family, and I believe I do, they're not going to stick Clyde down here to sweat away in the shit pits forever. No, they'll move him around department to department, and eventually they'll find a home for him, probably somewhat higher up in the pecking order, probably best to keep in this kid's good graces, because we don't know where he's going to end up. You know, he could bring up Kemmerer with him, for all we know. We don't know. That's the point. So treat him with respect. Now, that being said, I hope Kemmerer's treating everybody with respect. I understand with these immigrants, sometimes you got to crack the whip a little bit, you know? They're coming from this old world mentality. Not here in America, kids. Where you work like you've just been shocked with an electric prod, that's how you make it in this country. Don't you forget it. Wiggum, for this reason, after Clyde had gone, whispered to Kemmerer, as well as to several others, that Clyde might readily prove to be someone who was a protege of the chief. And therefore, they determined to watch their step, at least until they knew what his standing here was to be. And Clyde, noticing this, was quite set up by it, for he could not help but feel that this in itself, and apart from whatever his cousin Gilbert might either think or wish to do, might easily presage some favor on the part of his uncle that might lead to some good for him. So when Kemmerer proceeded to explain to him that he was not to think that the work was so very hard or that there was so very much to do for the present, Clyde took it with a slight air of condescension, and in consequence, Kemmerer was all the more respectful. "Just hang up your hat and coat over there in one of those lockers," he proceeded mildly and ingratiatingly even. No, I wasn't particularly ingratiating. Let me try that again. "Just hang up your hat and coat over there in one of those lockers," he proceeded mildly and ingratiatingly even. "Then you can take one of those crate tracks back there and go up to the next floor and bring down some webs. They'll show you where to get them." The days that followed were diverting and yet troublesome enough to Clyde, who, to begin with, was puzzled and disturbed at times by the peculiar social and workaday worlds and position in which he found himself. For one thing, those by whom now he found himself immediately surrounded at the factory were not such individuals as he would ordinarily select for companions, far below bellboys or drivers or clerks anywhere. They were, one and all, as he could now clearly see, meaty or stodgy mentally and physically. They wore such clothes as only the most common laborers would wear, such clothes as are usually worn by those who count their personal appearance among the least of their troubles, their work and their heavy material existence being all. In addition, not knowing just what Clyde was or what his coming might mean to their separate and individual positions, they were inclined to be dubious and suspicious. Yes, he's a real fish out of water here, isn't he? You know, these kids in the shrinking room, they've probably been there for quite a while, and I bet they're pretty damn good at their jobs, too. You know, they work hard, and they keep their noses clean, and they're just trying to put a couple of nickels together to feed their families. And then they see this bright-eyed kid with the last name of an emperor coming in among themselves and trying to do the same work. And he's not working as hard as they are. They can clearly see that. He's not given tough duties. They can clearly see that. And so they're going to be resentful of him. They're not going to like that he's being treated like somebody important when they've been working there for forever. Nobody gives them the time of day. So sure, they're going to be resentful. And Clyde is going to be resentful of them because he can feel their resentment. And Kemmerer, what's his deal? The whole thing is everybody's trying to get ahead here. Every single person in this story is just trying to get ahead. And they view each other as rivals and competitors. And the suspicion between them is intense. I'm reminded now of Upton Sinclair. I don't know if you guys have ever read The Jungle about slaughterhouses in Chicago around this same time. I'm just going to look up when was, got the old research machine cranked up. When was The Jungle published? Oh, earlier than I thought. So 1905, it was a huge hit. So there was already a kind of a whiff of social commentary clearly in the air and attracting a lot of noise and attention. And so perhaps we can, perhaps Dreiser had The Jungle in the back of his mind at least a little bit as he's putting together his own social critical novel here. And if we remember The Jungle, it's pretty harsh. You know, they're just, he's describing just the lives of these workers and how awful it is. And, you know, Dreiser, that's clearly not Dreiser's mission here. But he's not shying away from the mores and politics of the different social classes. Interesting, don't you think? I think so. Meanwhile, the light is fading here in my room, so I have to squint and sneeze and breathe all at the same time. Very difficult. After a week or two, however, coming to understand that Clyde was a nephew of the president, a cousin of the secretary of the company, and hence not likely to remain here long in any menial capacity, they grew more friendly, but inclined in the face of the sense of subserviency which this inspired in them to become jealous and suspicious of him in another way, exactly as I just said, because I am a literary mansplainer. For after all, Clyde was not one of them, and under such circumstances could not be. He might smile and be civil enough, yet he would always be in touch with those who were above them, would he not? Or so they thought. He was, as they saw it, part of the rich and superior class, and every poor man knew what that meant. The poor must stand together everywhere. For his part, however, I mean, that's a very socialist, well, dare I say, communistic thing to say. The poor must stand together everywhere. The proletariat. Marching in lockstep against the petty bourgeoisie. For his part, however, and sitting about for the first few days in this particular room eating his lunch, he wondered how these men could interest themselves in what were to him such dull and uninteresting items. The quality of the cloth that was coming down in the webs, some minute flaws in the matter of weight or weave. The last 20 webs hadn't looked so closely shrunk as the preceding 16. Or the Cranston Wickwire Company was not carrying as many men as it had the month before. Or the Anthony Woodenware Company had posted a notice that the Saturday half-holiday would not begin before June 1st this year, as opposed to the middle of May last year. They all appeared to be lost in the humdrum and routine of their work. Well, of course they are. This is their lives. Why wouldn't they? It's important for them to know whether some manufacturing concern is taking on workers or letting them go, or whether half Saturdays are to be honored in May or in June, because all of that affects their lives as well. They probably have friends, relatives, neighbors working in these factories enjoying their half days. They probably understand the pressure that one factory owner can put on another. You know, to make half days on Saturdays move up or move down on the calendar year, all kinds of things will be of interest to them, including the weight and weave of the particular cloth on the webs that is being sent down. I mean, this is their jobs. This is their livelihoods. And the sooner Clyde gets that into his thick head, the better off we will all be. Idiot. In consequence, his mind went back to happier scenes. He wished at times he were back in Chicago or Kansas City. He thought of Ratterer, Hegland, Higby, Louise Ratterer, Larry Doyle, Mr. Squires, Hortense, all of the young and thoughtless company of which he had been a part. He wondered what they were doing. What had become of Hortense? She had got that fur coat after all, probably from that cigar clerk, and then had gone away with him after she had protested so much feeling for him, the little beast. After she had gotten all that money out of him, the mere thought of her, and all that she might have meant to him if things had not turned as they had, made him a little sick at times. To whom was she being nice now? How had she found things since leaving Kansas City? And what would she think if she saw him here now, or knew of his present high connections? Gee, that would cool her a little. But she would not think much of his present position, that was true. But she might respect him more if she could see his uncle and his cousin and this factory in their big house. It would be like her then to try to be nice to him. Well, he would show her if he ever ran into her again. Snub her, of course, as no doubt he very well could by then. End of chapter 25, which we are leaving on something of a bitter note, as Clyde recommences thoughts of Hortense Briggs. That heartbreaker, that hussy, that fur coat wearing a street urchin. Really no better than that, I have to say, the way she uses and abuses. But again, like everybody else in this book, she's a striver. She's just trying to get ahead. I don't blame her. Don't blame her for a second. What else is she supposed to do? Sit around Kansas City her whole life? Working in some shop trying to save up enough money for the fur coat when she could just get some Tom, Dick, or Harry to pay for it for her? All she has to do is show a little ankle. Well, who wouldn't take that deal? Hortense would, and she did. And now she's gone. Come east with her fella on her arm. Well, that marriage probably isn't going to last long, and I suspect Clyde will bump into Hortense again at some point down the road. And I suspect that will cause some trouble for everybody involved. But until then, we'll just keep plodding along in an American tragedy. We'll leave it for now and pick it up again on another supercilious episode. What does supercilious mean? No word just popped into my head. And once I hear it, I'll know. Behaving or looking as though one thinks one is superior to others. So, yes, supercilious is in fact the perfect word to describe perhaps this episode or the next. But we will pick it up on another supercilious episode. And also, supercilious is very close to just saying super silly, which is very fun. We'll pick it up on another super silly episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu.
This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. We rely on you, the listeners, for support, so please go to patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack, and you will get early access to ad-free episodes and more content from me. That's patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack. See you next time.